This podcast is brought to you with limited interruption by Rudy Luther Toyota. Whether looking for an exciting brand new Toyota, a certified pre-owned vehicle, or getting quality routine maintenance and service for your vehicle, Rudy Luther Toyota is the place to go. Rudy Luther Toyota, the southeast corner of 394 and 169 in Golden Valley. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It's the Matt McNeil Show for your Monday. Good to be with you today. Matt and Patrick here today. A lot to get to. By the way, a chance of some storms moving in a little bit later on this afternoon. So keep an eye on the radar. You know, possibly some wind, possibly some hail, but just keep an eye on that. Coming up in the 4 o'clock hour, we got the return of Professor Tanisha Fazal. She's an expert in political science over at the University of Minnesota and also an expert in basic, kind of a unique field, military medical preparedness. And we had her on the air to talk about the Russian-Ukrainian conflict and how the Russians are in real big trouble because they just don't have the military infrastructure in place. It's medical supplies more than anything. We're going to have her talk about that and why the Ukrainians need medical supplies more than they need cluster bombs at this point, plus her overall view of what's going on lately within Ukraine, Russia, and where she feels it's going to be going. We'll talk to her once again. That's coming up in the 4 o'clock hour. But on the 4th of July, I got wind of a TikTok video, which, yeah, kind of took off a little bit here. The video showed a woman in Little Ruse in Chaska. It's a children's clothing store that was upset because their story time was going to have a drag queen come in for their story time. Now, they've had story time. Lots of other people have come in and spoken, and for some reason, this sent this individual off the edge, other people as well. Little Ruse stood by themselves and had the story time this last weekend. A huge success, a very large turnout, and good for them. There was a protest, a smaller one, but by far more people there to support Little Ruse and the decision to stay with the Drag Queen Story Hour as opposed to the people that were protesting it. And I like I said, you stand up to bullies and you see the reality is that most people are good people and are standing on your side. And that's exactly why I've invited Marissa Nordling on to chat with us, the owner of Little Ruse in Chaska, to chat about what happened this weekend and what led up to this weekend as well. Marissa, thank you very much. I really appreciate the time.
Absolutely. Thank you for reaching out.
Well, congratulations. And by the way, nicely done on, you've got a fairly thriving social TikTok page there. I've talked to the band Dury out of Burnsville. It's not easy to do that. You guys have had a lot of success there and a lot of hits on a lot of your videos there. Congratulations on that alone.
Thank you. Yeah, social media altogether can be a difficult platform, but yeah, it really took off for us.
Thank God I have another site I have to update almost daily. All right, so I get wind of this video, and this is the first time I was made aware of this. Now, first of all, Little Ruse, describe exactly what your store is, and the fact you guys have been doing Story Hour regularly for a while now, correct?
Correct. So we are a children's boutique. We do toys, books, games, but our main focus, and that's where we started online, was handmade clothing.
Yeah.
All of our clothing is cut, sewn here in our shop, and all of our bows are tied by local moms here in Carver County.
Wonderful. And, I mean, you've been around. How long has your store been open for?
We have been open for 4.5 years at this location for a year now. And when we first moved here, we had tons of space, so I thought having more free events, because we do bubble parties, face painting already, princess story time. So we added a new story time series this summer. And yeah, it's really taken off.
Now, I want to encourage anyone, a great way to help support you guys. I imagine you can stop by the store in Chaska. What's the address of the store down there?
We are at 122 Pioneer Trail here in Chaska, up in the Chaska Commons. And stopping in is great because our employees have been the front line of everything that's happening, and they just really love seeing the positivity still come in.
And if you're in somewhere else in the metro area where Chaska is not easy, you do have online ordering you can do, correct?
Correct. We started with an online business, so we have a very extensive website, which is littleruse.mn.com.
I'll get back to that here in a little bit. So you got your story hour. You by all accounts, it looks like you had a fairly eclectic group of people coming in to do story time, correct?
Yes. So we start with Princess Storytime, and then people started asking if we were going to do anything besides princesses. So I really researched things that were happening at local venues and libraries. And besides having local authors, I kept seeing Drag Storytime. I mentioned it to my staff, and one of them has a child within the LGBTQ community and knew that misdiagnosis was a native here in Chaska and did these story times. So I thought it'd be great to reach out and see if misdiagnosis would be wanting to come volunteer to add that to our story time lineup with local authors and other community members too.
A good call too. I took my kids to two drag story hours. It's a hoot. It's an absolute hoot. They had a great time. It's great fun for the kids. They enjoy it. And let's face it, anytime anyone wants to sit down and read a story to a kid, that's a good thing.
Yes, very positive experience. It is dress up and positivity and just embracing who you are. And I think misdiagnosis really knocked it out of the park, and all the kids were so engaged. It's just great to have self-love and reading all in the same spot.
How long ago did the protesters start going down to the store and addressing you, whether that's phone calls, emails, in person, like that the TikTok video is? How long ago did that start?
We really started receiving negativity about a week or two after we posted the event online. All of our free events are posted to our Facebook page under the events tab. Some local people must have got wind of it. And then, as you see with the lady in the TikTok and some others, some took it upon themselves to come in and tell us in person how they felt. And then it just kind of went in waves from there.
I will say this. I'm almost more shocked at the other TikTok video of the woman doing the dance routine. That's just comedy gold right there. I'm shocked that one didn't take off more than it did. How many total people? I mean, it's pretty brazen to walk into a private business and start yelling at them and disparaging employees about them doing something very legal within their private business. How many total people do you feel came in at any given, during this whole process to berate the staff?
We've had about a handful that came in, but I would definitely say for that handful, we've had dozens and dozens and dozens more come in to show their support. Just today, we've had close to 10 people just walk in to say,
"Nice,
thank you for inviting us. We appreciate a business that follows through with beliefs and keep inviting us and other members of the community to the supportive atmosphere."
By the way, this is me saying this. This has nothing to do with you. You hear that, Target? Okay. Anyway, that was me saying it. You hear that, Target? Okay. So how much debate did you have before this event to say, because this really did take off. I mean, the one video has over 11 million views. It's the publicity. I don't imagine that the individual there was happy with the publicity. But the reality is, there comes a point when you see this kind of take off and kind of create its own marketing world. How difficult was it for you to kind of, when you were considering this, was it for you to say, you know what, we're going to stay with this?
Not difficult at all.
Okay.
I had no hesitation, and I had amazing people reach out and help us. One of them was Darcy Bowman, and she asked me in the beginning, if it ever gets to be too much, just let me know. And I said, absolutely, we're not canceling this. This will always move forward. I am a private business. I am a small business owner, and this is what we believe in. This is a part of my employees' life, and there was never a doubt in my mind that we would ever cancel it.
So you have it here now. Just a quick side note. I'll never forget when I was talking to Darcy about this. I'll never forget when they had the pro Confederate flag rally and six total people showed up. And there's this tendency for the media to focus on the protesters and not the crowd, the overwhelmingly large crowd that is in support of the positivity. Your crowd here, do you have any guesstimates of how many people showed up in support of you on Saturday?
I don't know an exact number. I've seen some people say 500 plus, and I'm sure that's just a rolling total. But I do feel like there was so much support that you could not focus on any negativity. And if you were in the crowd, you wouldn't even know anything that was happening around us. It was very seamless. We had some great support. There were just tons and tons and tons of people here just wanting to show up to spread the love.
And what time? Now, your event was at 11, correct?
Yes.
What time did they start showing up?
I would say right around 10 o'clock.
Okay.
We had people start moving in, and then around 10:30, it got pretty busy from there. But by noon, everything was kind of packed up, and everybody was on their way. So it was a quick event, but just tons of people, tons of love, and yeah, it worked really great.
I hope some good sales for you because you're a business standing by, good principles out there. And by the way, can I say this to the city of Chaska? How about that? They just brought 500 people in on a Saturday into Chaska. That's a good thing. I guarantee you there's restaurants and other businesses that benefited from this. So good on you there helping to support the local community as well beyond your own business. There was a bit of a counter protest, a smaller counter protest, but this is the kind of thing which I really appreciate what you did. You exposed the fact that this was a relatively small group, a few dozen people at most, who showed up and basically were screaming hysterically just at the wind, I guess, because the reality is even they have to admit they're on the wrong side of this, that the vast majority of people in Chaska, in the Twin Cities, in Minnesota are on your side. They were the minority, and it got exposed to them because it was a relatively small counter-protest.
Yes. And the wind was definitely not in their favor either.
No. And I want to say, they really... There were a lot of people that were there saying, no, we're not going to allow you to do what you have seen in some other places across the country where, these people kind of work themselves into a lather. There was a great public television story out from last year, which said in the case of the fight against drag queens, a lot of the people that are against them try to feel as if they're the hero of their story, that they've created this false narrative that they're the real hero. And I think that when you get that kind of zealotry involved, that sometimes it can really go horribly wrong. For the most part, I think the crowd that showed up for you really kind of showed these guys, you're not on the right side of this. And as well as, thank you to the Chaska law enforcement who are there to make sure nothing bad happened. But the reality is they got put in their place and exposed for the fringe mentality that they really are.
Yeah, I completely agree. Besides our local police department, who was here to help be a buffer, we did have some amazing companies like Outfront Minnesota reach out, and they sent out volunteers. They sponsored Squarity to come out, and they had a team out here. But besides the positivity, we also had those other companies who wanted to be a part of this event, helping coach people in the crowd. Don't engage, just focus on positivity. Twin Cities Pride brought out tons of flags so we can make a flag wall. There was nice. Just a lot done by people who donated their time, volunteers and such, that helped create such a positive environment and really helped diffuse any situation that would arise where we didn't run into any conflicts. It was great.
I imagine a lot of happy kids, too, getting good story time.
Oh, yes. I got pulled in every direction to look at their chalk art. That's mostly how I spent my time. And I'm still picking up all the glitter all over the sidewalk here.
Well, leave the glitter. It's good. Glitter is good. It's a good thing. The, it is a great lesson here. And by the way, also, if I may, to all your employees there, all my big salute to them. It is not easy being on the front line of something like this, especially when you're just going in there to work in a store and all of a sudden you get this coming in the door. A big round of applause to all of them for standing firm as well and having to deal with the brunt of this arrogance and ignorance that was coming in the door.
Yes, I truly have the most amazing staff. Most have been with me since the beginning of our company. They really stick around. So they care about the company. They care about the same beliefs. And like I said, this idea came from an employee's child being in the LGBTQ community. So we all support that family, which is a part of our team. And they do not hesitate to stand up and kill people with kindness. Because if you come in and you're riled up, you know what? That is okay, and you have a great day.
Well, and I and from your TikTok video, I would have responded a little differently. I'm just going to be honest with you. That one of it, you were so polite. That's obviously a fantastic a sign about you and your character there as the whole staff. I got to point out something here, though, and for all the people, all the haters, the negativity. Do you feel as if the turnout would have been nearly as big if not for the haters trying to bully you away from doing this?
I do believe we would have had a good group, but to this amount, definitely not. Their negativity is what propelled this event to become how big it is and how positive it is, and just such a great turnout in general. And hate really, I guess, brought all the positivity together.
Hey, this is me saying this too. Hey, suck on that, haters. All right, so that's just me saying that. Because you see, once again, I don't have the kindness and compassion of you. You are a better person.
Just say, have a great day. Just have a great day. I mean, there's different words.
Have a great day. Even I can. I shouldn't be working the front desk. All right, so, okay. Story time is going to continue. I imagine you got this running through the summer?
Yes, this will run through the end of the summer along with other free events like freezies and face paints and more princess story time.
So if people are down in Chaska, once again, it's 122 Pioneer Trail, correct?
Correct.
122. And littleroosmn.com is the website, right?
Yes.
Fantastic. Absolutely. I can't applaud you enough. I can't respect you enough. You stood up to the bullies. And once again, if you stand up to the bullies, you realize the bullies are pretty much a minority and they're not really, you know, they're not worthy to bend to. So you didn't. Congratulations on that. All my best to everyone down there. Congratulations on a great story hour and all my best. I hope things continue in a positive way for you down there. Okay.
Thank you so much.
Marissa Nordling is the owner of Little Ruse in Chaska. Once again, having their story time down there. LittleRuseMN.com. Find out more information about the events down there as well. And buy some things, for goodness sakes. Help support a good business, that's for sure. We'll take a break. Come on back. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota, is the Matt McNeil Show. Now, I will say this very bluntly. This whole anti-trans thing is just a made-up outrage. You know, we had, what was it, the movie Two White Chicks? You had Bosom Buddies. Bob Hope used to dress in drag. Milton Berle. No one cared. The Monty Python. The Kids in the Hall. No one cared. Until the Republicans lost Roe v. Wade as their talking point. And then when they lost Roe v. Wade, they had to basically find something to replace abortion because, once again, one of the main reasons they lost badly last election was abortion. And people were like, oh, you're taking away my rights now? Okay, the heck with that. And they don't have a counterpunch for it because even though some moderate Republicans have said, we need to get away from the abortion issue. The Republicans are doubling down, tripling down, quadrupling down in some places because that's where they're at. But in states like Minnesota, where it's not going to fly, you have to create a new villain. And so for all these lemmings, these brainless zombies that have to basically told what to hate, the former anti-Roe v. Wade people are now basically saying drag queens evil, transgender evil. And suddenly, guess what? The people are showing up and start screaming about Drag Queen Story Hour like it's the greatest sin of all time. You're broken people. And it should not be lost in any capacity. It should not be lost that this event would never have been as big as it was if not for you haters giving it the spotlight it got. And I want to put this out to all you little bigots out there in the metro area that are against the LGBTQIA and transgender community and the drag queen community. I want to give it a little something to you. Go make a big deal out of this. And then watch as the event you're trying to bully to shut down ends up having the biggest crowd they've ever had at that store. Just go away. You're a small, small minority, as proven by the turnout in Chaska. You're a small minority. Go away. You're just upsetting people. And let other people, I don't know, be Christian, welcome, compassion, loving, caring. That's what Christians are supposed to be. Not screaming about, oh, you need a hate. But that's just me. 952-946-6205. Oh, Patrick, tonight's our first big broadcast of Greg Bakken show, Ghost Box Radio, at 10 o'clock tonight, right?
Yep, five nights a week, 10 o'clock, Greg Bakken now hosting Ghost Box Radio, moving from its Sunday afternoon slot to what I think is a much more appropriate time.
Rick Smith, Greg Bakken, and Patty Vasquez. Right, ding, ding, ding. Our late night crew, right there for you. All right? You're not going to miss out. That's some good programming right there. 10 o'clock tonight, Greg Bakken, Ghost Box Radio, right here on AM 950. On Sunday, were you running perchance across the tarmac at MSP?
That was not me, fortunately.
You did see the story, though. Okay, here you go. From Fox 9, a passenger on Sun Country flight from Orlando opened the emergency hatch, jumped on the wing, and fled across the tarmac at Terminal 2 late Sunday night, according to the MSP Air Force officials. So this was on the ground when he opened the door. The flight from Orlando landed shortly after 11 p.m., and according to sources, MSP police were waiting for the suspect at the gate. However, before they could board the plane to take the suspect into custody, he opened the emergency hatch, went onto the wing, jumped off, ran across the tarmac toward the terminal. Police located the suspect about 45 minutes later, hiding in an LSG Sky Chief truck.
That's not a short drop.
That's a bit of a run too, man. You're because you just landed. They hadn't. Where are you running to? MSP Fox 9 reached out to the Sun Country, which said the passenger was seated at the exit row. We take this incident seriously. The police responded quickly. Apparently, what was it? He violated a contact order, and that's the reason why they were looking to take him in custody. Okay. I guarantee you now, whatever problems you had before that moment, I gotta imagine he broke about five or six laws. Doing the door thing on the plane, running across a secure zone, you're going to be spending some time in jail, idiot. So, I hope you had a good time. I hope you did the Orlando stuff. I hope you did Disney World. I mean, that's, you know, if you're one last trip before you go to the pokey, there you go. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. So, when we do return, I have to do an intervention with Republicans. Because apparently they don't understand basic math. And I'm going to enjoy educating them when we do return. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. Take a break. Come on back. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. It is a warm day out there, man. Crotch sweat canyon. It's supposed to cool down, but unfortunately, we're supposed to have some storms tonight. So just keep an eye on the weather. I posted Sven's Bring Me the News forecast, and it could go further south than us. Could happen right over the metro area. Needless to say, just. You know, don't be surprised. And there's a chance of some hail out there. So just keep that in mind. 952-946-6205. So let's talk about math, shall we? Math is an important thing. It is painfully clear to me at this point that there are a lot of people in this country that don't even have basic math skills. And I don't bring this up lightly just because this is my first foray into the insult. No, no, no. There's something that I got posted on Saturday that I've run into a lot of far-right trolls. And and not only far-right trolls, but far-right elected House of Representative trolls. Hey, dear Lord, man. Can't believe you guys are representing people. God, what a joke. Anyway, that these trolls are basically trying to push for their narrative. And the reality is I think it's become clear they don't understand basic math. So I'm going to take some time here to explain some basic math. Now, I'm going to give you a term, per capita, okay? Per capita is an interesting thing because there's a lot of times, especially in this world, that the world is not perfect. It's every town does not have 10,000 people in it. So that if you want to compare one town to another town, that generally you have to adjust for the fact that one town might have 75,000 people in it. The other town might have 300 people in it. But if you want to compare how things are going in one town to another town, you have to adjust that. Per capita is a Latin term that translates to by head. I believe per capita means the average per person and is often used in place of per person for statistical observation. The phrase can be used for almost any kind of population description, but common when discussing, societal and economic data. All right. So basically, it's a way for you to be able to fairly evaluate one situation and another situation, even though those two situations would not be necessarily easy to compare on face value. Let me give you a great example of this. Movie theaters. Say you have a city with 2 million people in it. And people say, well, isn't that city great? That city with 2 million people in it has 200 movie theaters. Those are real cinephiles over there. They know their movies. They love their movies. And then they look at some town that has 4,000 people in it. And they say, look at that town. God, that town's pathetic. They only have 4 movie theaters there. The big city's got 200 movie theaters. That one has only got 4. So the people in this big city are far bigger fans of movies. Now, as one could say, and imagine if you were in small town America, you might be like, hey, wait a minute, that's not a fair comparison. Yeah, you're right. Funny how when it goes against you, all of a sudden you become math wishes sometimes. But it isn't a fair comparison because you're looking at the number of 200 for a city of 2 million versus 4 for the city of 4,000. So what you do is you look at per capita. So per a specific amount of people. 1,000 people, 100,000 people, whatever the case may be. In this specific case I have made up, the number of movie theaters per the 2 million town, it's 200 movie theaters, they're 2 million. That means one movie screen per every 10,000 people. In the smaller town, where it's 4 movie screens, but it's 4,000 people, that's one movie screen for every 1,000 people, which means that smaller town actually has a higher per capita movie screen application in their community than in the big community. See how that works? So it's a way for you to break down what exactly is a fact or a statistic in a fair way when you have two things you're comparing of two very different sizes. Because stupid idiots like to sit there and say, big number, bigger than small number, me smart. Apparently as a house rep. But I don't know. But that's what they like. That's stupid because big number there, small number there, big number. I'm smart guy. I'm not going to get tired of doing that. So let me go to what brought about this. Renee Herskovitz posted up on Twitter a tweet post, which is about the National Incident-Based Reporting System is an incident-based reporting system used by law enforcement agencies in the U.S. for collecting and reporting data on crimes. Local, state, and federal agencies generate NIBRS data from their records management systems. Data is collected from on every incident and arrest in a group of Group A offense category. These Group A offenses are 52 offenses grouped in 23 crime categories. Specific facts about these offenses are garnered and reported to the NIBRS. So basically what this is it's a database that goes on out there and will grab the amount of certain levels of crimes that are committed within a certain community, all right? What she noticed, what Renee noticed, is that if you factor in and you adjust this for population, aka per capita, that Minneapolis is not the most dangerous city in the state. It's not the second most dangerous. It's not the third most dangerous. As a matter of fact, Minneapolis itself comes in at number 4. And if you combine it with St. Paul, which is number 11, it actually, the two of them together, would be number 5 with Mankato in 4th place. Now, let me run through some of this data here from this database. 10 most dangerous cities in Minnesota. Bemidji. Bemidji's population is 15,574. There are 515 crime cases in 2021. It is the most dangerous cities in Minnesota by 2023. Violent crime occur at a rate of about 33.07 per 1,000 residents. So that's basically taking all the data from the National Incident-Based Reporting System that is reported in all of these communities. Equally, I've had one or two customers say, well, in Minneapolis, they don't report that. No, they do. And how would they know about these crimes if they didn't report them? Mega! You know, so that's, you kind of get the idea. So basically, they take the population, they take the number of crimes, they do a per capita rating, and that's the rating they go with. Bemidji is the most dangerous city in the state. Bemidji recorded one homicide, 5 kidnappings, 37 sex offenses, 11 rape cases in the crime against property. There were 5 arsons, 42 motor vehicle thefts, 12 robberies, and 249 drug narcotic offenses. Brainerd is number 2. Brainerd. The population is 13,436. There are 423 crime cases in 2021. Second most dangerous city in Minnesota by 2023, violent crime may occur in the rate of about 31.48 per 1,000 residents. Once again, the same number. And once again, Bemidji and Brainerd are not the same size. Bemidji's larger, 15,574. Brainerd is 13,436. So you still need to do a per capita to be able to evaluate these two towns away from each other. So if you're saying, well, that's fine to evaluate them, but you can't do it for Minneapolis. No, this is how you do it, you idiots. I almost said something else. You morons. This is how you do it. It's called basic math. Brainerd. 31.48 per 1,000 residents. Brainerd reported 3 kidnappings, 35 sex offenses, 12 rape cases. The crime against property thefts were 37 motor vehicle theft, 4 robbery, 538 drug narcotic offenses. Waite Park. Now, that was a bit of a surprise. Waite Park comes in at number 3. Population of 7,839. There are 237 crime cases in 2021. Their rate is 30.23. So even Waite Park's a good 3 points behind Bemidji. Recorded 4 kidnappings, 13 sex offenses, 8 rape cases in the crime against property. There was 1 arson, 25 motor vehicle thefts, 10 robberies, 71 drug narcotic offenses. Then finally comes what Republicans want to scream is, the most dangerous place in the entire state! Ah! Minneapolis. Which, by the way, I was out at Minneapolis this weekend a few times. On Saturday, by the way, you know that hellscape war zone, you know, apocalypse, you know, nuclear zone, that's the no-go zone, that's Minneapolis. You could walk on the kayaks, paddleboards, and canoes on Lake of the Isles all the way across that lake. There were so many people out. And I know, Republicans, I know what you're about to say. Not those areas. Well, that's Minneapolis, right? Yeah. Shut up then. Okay. You're not welcome in the city anymore, you arrogant idiots. Anyway, Minneapolis. Minneapolis' population is just a smidge higher than these other towns, 438,463. There were 9,457 crime cases in 2021. Now, I'm going to say something, which is what seems to be the entire point of all conservatives. Bigger number! Big, big number! Big number! That seems to be their counterpoint to the math of per capita. Undeniably, that is a big number there, Chauncey. We're not going to deny that. But once again, you have to do it per capita of per 1,000 residents. Fourth most dangerous city in Minnesota. Violent crime has occurred at a rate of about 21.57 per 100,000 residents. That is 12 points less than Bemidji. 12 points less than Bemidji. 12. Minneapolis recorded 102 homicides, 192 kidnappings, 714 sex offenses, 305 rape cases, motor vehicle, the crime against property, 116 arsons, 4,258 motor vehicle thefts, 2,217 robbery, 944 drug narcotic offenses. I had one guy say, Minneapolis is 15,000 carjackings a year. Well, no, actually, they reported 4,258, which is not ideal, but it's not freaking Rio, dude. 15,000, dear Lord. But you see, it's not about reality. This is reality. This per capita numbers. This is reality. This is reality. What's not reality is the response from the Republicans who are just like, because that's all they've got. Mankato comes in. Let's see here. Yeah, Mankato comes in next. 869 crime cases. Fifth most dangerous city in Minnesota. Violent crime can occur at the rate of 1984 per 100,000 residents. Actually, it's listed as six. So this was listed as six. But it would actually be Minneapolis, St. Paul combined, would it be behind it? Because St. Paul, let me go to St. Paul. St. Paul on this is minuscule. St. Paul's population is 309,957. There are 4,919 crime cases in 2021. Violent crime occurred at the rate of 15.85. It's half. St. Paul is half of what's going on in Bemidji and half of what's going on in Brainerd and half of what's going on in frickin' Waite Park, man. So this is called numbers. This is called math. And as you can imagine, the right-wing media has gone nutsoid over me posting this because it completely negates their narrative. They keep screaming, no, that! They say the data is skewed, even though it's a standard. I've done the numbers. I did the numbers myself. This is a standard per capita math problem. Divide one number by the other number. There you go. Their entire argument. I mean, it's amazing how belligerent they are. First of all, I will also say this. It's amazing how many people on the right will try to comment authoritatively on this information without actually reading this information. That's the sign of a complete and total moron. I mean, seriously, I'm going to speak authoritatively about something I have no idea about. I'm smart. No, it's not how it works, dude. Yeah, per capita, you're an idiot. So just FYI, I've done the math problem. You're dumb. But their entire argument is, there's far more crime in Minneapolis. But then when you point out, but there's far more people, that's irrelevant. You see, because it's not about facts. It's not about reality. It's about basically screaming their opinion and trying to outgrunt you into submission. As I went through these responses, it started to become pretty clear that this wasn't, I mean, there's only one, two things that could be here, that could be going on. Either all these Republicans, including some of these Republican politicians, are complete and total, are pretending to be complete and total dumbasses for the sake of basically just making their narrative true, that they're intentionally being stupid. Or, and this is even sadder, these grown adults don't understand basic math. And I think it's the latter. I think a shocking amount of conservatives on the right don't understand basic math. A per capita math problem is a that's a basic seventh grader problem. And I don't think you guys know how to do it or understand it. When you just kind of grunt around there like a freaking Neanderthal going, big number, small number, big number, small number, it shows me you don't understand basic math. But the real problem here, beyond all this, is the injustice that's happening because of Republicans' intentional or real ignorance. And I'm going to get to that when I come on back. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It's the Matt McNeil Show. I'm going to go see Katie Tesman on Thursday. I think I'm going to go do that. Good stuff over at the Park Tavern. The Matt McNeil Show. So once again, either these conservatives who are belligerently angry at the per capita number showing that actually Minneapolis is the fourth most dangerous city in the state, that actually Bemidji, Brainerd, and Waite Park actually are far worse than Minneapolis. Once again, they're either intentionally being dumbasses for the sake of just keeping their reality true, or they honestly do not understand math. Regardless, there is one thing that is happening here. We have a failure to address the real crime issues in outstate Minnesota, in areas where Republicans, for the most part, are representing these people. It's almost, my guess is going to be Republicans want to, part of the reason why Republican politicians might refuse to accept these numbers is because if they actually go on out there and say, wow, we've got to do something about the problems in Bemidji and in Brainerd, that they'll say, well, but then that's admitting that Minneapolis is in the worst. So it's almost as if they're belligerently refusing to help these communities who clearly need some help with their crime issues. Now, I did have one person bring up the point saying, well, Matt, to be fair here, the homicide rate's higher in Minneapolis. A lot of these cases are drug-related and stuff like that. I'm not going to deny that there is definitely the individual categories can vary. But it's still the when you factor in all the dangerous, the Class A offenses, that basically these cities are more dangerous than Minneapolis. But, you know, this has been the real legacy of Republican law enforcement policy in rural America. Drug cases are through the roof. Drug addiction is through the roof. They don't care. They do not care because their only thing is, it doesn't matter what state it is to vilify the big bad city that they can just to basically look like they're doing something and not doing any damn thing at all. I would like to see the DFL get on out there and put money to our crime task force for the entire state, including Bemidji and Brainerd and Waite Park and all these other communities that are having problems. Because if all these Republicans are doing is focusing on Minneapolis, even though they have freaking nothing to do with Minneapolis outside of trying to use it to scare, let's be honest, white people into voting for them because look at those minorities down there. And that's your entire argument. Well, they'll sit there and watch their own towns circle the toilet while they basically sit there and feel as if I've vilified the city, I've done my job. So DFL, I think it's worth your while to get out there and put together some real crime task force to deal with some real bad crime numbers in these towns that the Republicans are refusing to address. And once again, if I may, get some billboards out there. Pass the task force. Say, and on the billboards on the way into town, you say, Republicans have refused to deal with the crime issue in Bemidji. The DFL is taking care of it now. Because I can tell you right now, that's going to resonate in those communities. And I get it. You guys don't like to brag. Get over yourself, dude. Have you seen the other side? They're taking credit for bills that today that they proudly voted against yesterday. That's what you're dealing with. So you got to get out there and you got to brag and you got to point out the fact that you're taking care of business while the Republicans sit there and pretend to be internet trolls, because that's the only thing that freaking matters to them. They don't care about their constituents. All they care about is the handful of people, other internet trolls, that worship them as the king troll within their district. And the end result is a failure to rural Minnesotans at the expense of Republican talking points. Hour two, that's coming up next. Hour number two of the show here on your Monday. Good to be with you. Once again, keep an eye on the weather here. We could get some storms tonight. Don't quite know. It depends on where they fire up. Could be a little hail. Could be a little wind. Could all be south of the metro area, too. Just keep an eye out there if you're heading out this evening. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. I want to welcome back to the show Professor of Political Science at the University of Minnesota, the Andrew Carnegie Fellow to this year. It is Professor Tanisha Fazal. She is kind enough to join us to talk a little bit about what is going on in Ukraine and Russia right now, particularly from the interesting point of military medical preparedness. And she's kind enough to take some time today to talk about this issue. Professor, thank you very much. Nice. Welcome back. Thank you very much for the time today.
Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. I want to point to an article that I'm going to post a little bit later on that you wrote here to help Ukraine send more first aid. And this obviously as the Biden administration has put forward the idea of sending over cluster bombs as a way to help out. Your comment to me was, instead of sending this over, we should be sending more medical aid. Is there a real need for medical aid right now for the Ukrainian troops?
I think there is. I mean, I think just in general, military medicine can really give countries an advantage in war. There was actually an article in the Wall Street Journal last week that the headline was something like Ukraine's military medicine gives it a quiet edge. And we know that Ukraine has better military medicine than Russia, at least right now. So the Russian case fatality rate, which is the percentage of people who are injured and actually reach a hospital, who reach medical care, is 20%. So about 20% of Russians are dying. But the Ukrainian one is lower at 14%, but ideally should be even lower. The reason that the Ukrainians have better medicine is, they have better tourniquets, and we know that hemorrhage is the main cause of preventable battle death. Mm-hmm. They're also using whole blood in a pre-hospital setting. They're getting a lot of medical aid, and they're trained on guidelines that were developed in the U.S. But I think it's especially important for the Ukrainians to receive medical aid because we all know that Ukraine is at a population disadvantage vis-a-vis Russia. There are just fewer Ukrainians than Russians, and so it's that much more important to be able to take better care of them.
Do you think part of the problem is that big countries like the U.S. and the U.K., Germany, the mentality is, well, we'll send in the big guns. We'll send in the munitions, the weaponry, the tanks. We'll send that stuff in. We'll leave it to, and just, pulling a country out, Albania. Albania will send over the support system. Is that part of it, the feeling that some of these countries that are sending aid over feel as if, well, since we're the big countries with the big military, clearly we want to send munitions, not the medical aid?
I think I would flip that a little bit and say that the issue is actually more that the Ukrainians, that's how the Ukrainians view it, the way that you just presented it. where they really want to get a lot of lethal aid. And they understandably see major powers, more advanced industrialized countries like the U.S., as an important source of that aid. But from the U.S. perspective, actually, there's a pretty strong argument to be not sending offensive aid, to send more defensive aid, right? Because that really lowers the risk of a confrontation with Russia, which is something that the U.S. rightly wants to avoid. And I think medical aid definitely fits that bill. And the reality also is that U.S. medical aid is just going to be better than Albanian medical aid.
Yes, well, it would, you know, and hey, I'm a veteran myself. I was always amazed by, you know, I know it's kind of stupid, but I grew up watching MASH and stuff. But then when you go into like a real field medical unit, when I was in military and we go out for field maneuvers, this was back in the early 90s. They were incredibly impressive back then. I can only imagine with the technological advances that, you know, in some cases it is like wheeling an actual hospital out to a conflict zone and being able to, you know, address, as you said, it's the importance of being able to address the injuries immediately and quickly, because if you can do that, you're going to get those soldiers back into the field fairly quickly.
I think that, yeah, that's exactly right. And that's part of a big part of the story of why the U.S. is so successful. I would say that military medicine is one of the few successes of the Afghan and Iraq wars, or the few silver linings. I don't even know what the right word here is, but, But I think it's important to recognize, and this goes to a point you were just making, that one of the reasons that there was such great success on the military and medical front in those wars was because the U.S. had air superiority against its foes in Iraq and Afghanistan. So there was uncontested airspace, and so the U.S. could really leverage air evacuation. Now, if we turn to the war between Ukraine and Russia, the airspace is very much contested, and so evacuation times are much longer. So the U.S. operated under what was called the Golden Hour policy in Afghanistan starting in 2009, which meant that if somebody was injured, they had to be evacuated to a higher-level medical facility in under an hour, because we know that getting medical care in that time frame greatly increases the odds of survival. In Ukraine, it's taking a lot of times closer to a day to get from the front to a hospital. So you're not able to send somebody, you know, a medevac chopper or, you know, a flying ICU in the way that the U.S. is able to in Afghanistan and Iraq.
So for medical aid, obviously you talked about, you know, in very bluntly, you know, tourniquets, being able to stop the bleeding on the field. I remember shock as well is another huge, problem when you have, you know, soldiers that have been injured and trying to, you know, get them back in a reasonable time. What other medical aid would you suggest the U.S. get to Ukraine right now?
Well, I think that there are two main kinds. One has to, certainly we have to keep supplying them with modern tourniquets. I mean, if you watch videos on social media, you'll see that the Russians have been using basically a strip of rubber, like World War II era tourniquets. Modern tourniquets, you can self-apply, you can tighten them one-handed. They're actually sometimes called a one-handed tourniquet. But there's a lot of, things like better, you know, up-armored ambulances, just basic supplies, right, gauze, et cetera. And a lot of charities are stepping into the breach, but what they're doing is not necessarily, as their efforts are, by definition, not as centralized. But another important contribution that the U.S. could make in the military and medical front is simply training. So a lot of Ukrainian forces have been trained in what's called tactical combat casualty care, which is a set of guidelines and practices that the U.S. developed during the Afghanistan and Iraq wars and has been shown to put it bluntly, save a lot of lives. But in order to really train people, it gets a little tricky because it's really hard to get Ukrainian forces to Poland, for example, for training, and we don't necessarily want to have U.S. forces in Ukraine. So I think that bureaucratically is one of the challenges in moving forward on that particular issue.
Professor Tanisha Fazal is joining us, professor of political science over at the University of Minnesota Twin Cities. We talked about Russia last time as well. And you had made the point that this was they were having the same problem basically the entire military was, is that through black market sales, troops and supplies that were supposed to be there for these military units just were not in the numbers they needed for what they were about to try to do. Where are they at right now? Because it doesn't sound like, and it's hard to get real information about this. I imagine you get much better sources. Where are the Russians at? Because it sounded like reality is that they're in a much worse situation as far as the medical care their troops are receiving in that combat zone.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I wouldn't necessarily assume that I have much better information, because we should note that casualty statistics are part of the information warfare landscape here. Neither side wants to reveal what their own casualty numbers are, for example. So, with respect to Russia, what I would say is that there has been some improvement in medical care over the past year, but it's pretty minimal, especially compared to what the Ukrainians have been doing. So the Ukrainians, in contrast to the Russians, are starting to use whole blood in a pre-hospital, very forward setting, which is, goes to your point earlier about dealing with hemorrhage. But I think that we see the effects of poor Russian military medicine in a few different dimensions. There's poor medical care for the troops. Here I'm guessing a little bit, but what we know about who's fighting and who's been fighting on the Russian side lately is that, there are conscripts. A lot of them are recently released prisoners. And so their health is not that great to start with. They know that they won't receive good medical care, and that is that knowledge is going to lower their morale and therefore make them less willing to fight. I mean, we see Russian troops oftentimes described as cannon fodder, and when you see in the media interviews with Russian troops, they're describing themselves as cannon fodder. Mm. So they understand what's what.
Well, and that's an interesting part of it, because it's the whole thing. And once again, as a veteran, I mean, I think some of this stuff is very fascinating as far as learning how to keep feet dry in World War I, or, making sure you're feeding the troops, because if you're not feeding them, that's going to be a pretty big problem pretty quick. And so, you have to have clean water, you have to have good food, you have to have medicine, you have to have these support systems in place. And Russia just, at least not in a full scale military combat mode, they just don't have that. And as you said, there are a lot of videos of these soldiers saying, please do not send us to our death, because you're sending us out there without the equipment, without food, in some case without bullets, and in expecting them to be some sort of success ratio. It just doesn't seem to be there.
Yeah, I think the Russian strategy is just one of numbers. Mm-hmm. That's what they're trying to leverage, that they have just a much bigger population.
Any idea, you talked about the casualty rate, and the Ukrainians are saying 200,000 plus Russians have died. I saw one number which seemed to be, just looking at the formula there, it seemed to be lacking some potential numbers. They were saying 50,000 to 60,000. Any guess on how many Russians have died in Ukraine at this point, from what you've read?
No, I don't think I'd want to hazard a guess. I think the best numbers I can give you are the numbers that I started the conversation with, and this is from a DIA report about the case fatality rate, but that's just giving you a percentage as opposed to absolute numbers.
So 20% was that percentage, correct?
Yeah, I think the DIA said the Russian CFR is 20% and Ukraine's is about 14%. So about 1 in 5 Russian casualties are dying after they reach medical care, and about 1 in 7 of Ukrainian casualties.
So, and I know that, you've been focusing on this, and by the way, fascinating stuff. And I will post that article that you wrote about the medical aid to Ukraine, because I think that's a very incredibly valid point, especially since a lot of people are like trying to tap the brakes a little bit. It's like, what's this about cluster bombs now? I think it's a good argument that we can make that maybe this is a better way to address issues there. But let's looking at the conflict as a whole, and as much as, you're comfortable talking about, it seems as if there is a counteroffensive going on right now by Ukraine. Russia has blown up dams to basically try to slow it down. It does seem like it's not in any kind of speedy way, but it does seem like there are Ukrainian advances against the Russians right now. And as you said, there's a lot of videos of Russians basically saying, don't send us out there to be the cannon fodder. From what you're seeing, is that somewhat accurate, or are you seeing other information that's coming on down?
No, I think that's right. But, you know, there's a lot going on. It's not just what's happening on the battlefield. There's a NATO meeting about, and one of the questions, of course, is what Ukraine's status is going to be vis-a-vis NATO. There are a lot of questions circulating around, you know, the question of war termination. Should Ukraine and Russia be pushed toward a peace table? But it is interesting that there is, you know, this a lot of talk about the counteroffensive, and I think Zelensky is clearly trying to moderate expectations, either because things are maybe going a little bit more slowly than he thought, or maybe because the plan was always to have things, or the expectation was always that it was going to go slowly. Mm-hmm. But it does seem like they're making some advances. I don't see too many signs that this is going to end anytime soon.
I think
the advances are enough to end the war.
I agree with you. I look at Zelensky trying to just make enough advances to where it's going to be very hard for someone to come in saying, oh, well, you need to move back and give that territory that you've won back to the Russians. It makes it a much more complicated thing. If those individual states within Ukraine are still completely occupied by Russia, then there's the argument you could say, well, Russia will allow Russia to take those. But if Ukraine has made some advances into those states again, then it becomes a much more, you know, drawn out process if there's going to try to be some sort of forced peace. Are you from that slightly a little bit of Russian uprising from a few weeks ago? Did you take anything away from that? Because if anything, I was amazed at how weak the Russians looked at that point when they had the Warner Group basically, the Wagner Group kind of turn and basically storm towards Moscow. And it was interesting to see all the Russian leadership run to St. Petersburg to get out of Moscow. There seemed to be a real fear there that that government was going to get overthrown.
Yeah, I think it was, you know, interesting, I think, is too small a word to use to describe what it was like to watch that unfold. I think for me, there were two sets of questions or two takeaways. One, you know, I definitely agree with you about the exposure of the brittleness of the regime, but there were, you know, we all know Putin is a bad guy, but there are a lot of questions raised about if he were to fall, who would replace him? And could that person be worse? I think the answer is yes, that the person could be worse, but we don't know who that would be. But for me, another question, and, you know, I'm not an expert in Russian politics or Russian civil-military relations, but another question for me is, insofar as Russia is essentially trying to disband the Wagner Group, what implications does that have for the supply of troops? Mm-hmm. Given that that's who was supplying a pretty large percentage of Russian troops up until that, you know, would-be coup.
Well, and it definitely seems to be a lot of those troops are not loyal to Russia.
Correct.
Yeah. Now that is fascinating, and I don't think that's over. As a matter of fact, I think, is it fair to say from your assessment that Putin is seen as a much weaker leader today because of what happened there? That, I mean, he still is in charge of Russia. He still is there. He's still pushing into Ukraine. He's still putting on, you know, trying to dot the I's and cross the T's as this kind of despot leader. But the reality is when something like that happens, you can't help but look weaker than you want to portray. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think that you want to think about who the audience is. I think Putin does look weaker with respect to the rest of the world, given his control over media inside of Russia. I don't have a really clear sense of how weak he looks to the Russian population. But I will also say that insofar as he has been weakened, there's a potential upside to that, but there's also a potential downside, which is that he could be even more desperate, mm-hmm. which can, in desperate people, do desperate things.
Indeed. Professor, fascinating stuff. I'm going to make sure I post up the article a little bit later on. By all means, I appreciate you coming back. I'd love to have you back again once again a few months down the road to talk more about this, because obviously this is a incredibly complicated and complex situation, and you give some really great insight into something I think that is ignored in a lot of the news that's covered in regards to the Ukrainian conflict. So thank you very much. I appreciate the time today.
Good to be with you.
My pleasure. Professor Tanisha Fazal from the University of Minnesota, professor of political science, and an Andrew Carnegie fellow. We'll take a break. Come on back. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It's the Matt McNeil Show. It's fascinating stuff. And once again, do not underestimate the value. I understand. We, you know, and it was interesting for her to say the Ukrainians are the ones that are kind of asking for the heavy-duty weaponry. But don't underestimate the ability to maintain a fitter fighting force by having good equipment, more than just the fighting equipment, but, you know, whether that's boots, good clothes, you know, reliable vehicles to get to and fro, food, medical care. And the good thing is like I said, Ukraine seems to have a lot of this. I don't know where this is going to end up. I agree with the professor's analysis about Zelensky. I think that this is going harder than he thought it was, but I also wonder if the entire point, considering it's making advancements across various different former Ukrainian states that are currently currently occupied by Russians. I think the point is get to a situation where it'd be very difficult for a foreign moderator to come on out there and say, well, the Ukrainians who had clawed back the land that was theirs before the Russians there need to withdraw so that the Russians can take over that area. I don't know if the case. Plus the fact that if I can make an honest thing, considering that Russia has left Ukraine in shambles, there comes a point where they would have to spend billions of dollars to fix roads, you know, sewer lines, power lines, all these things, while at the same time getting shot at by the Ukrainians who don't want the Russians there, even if it was an occupied zone. And we talked about that a year plus ago when Ukraine took over and started occupying. Yeah, I don't understand what Russia's endgame is here, because it's not like you're going to easily occupy this, even if that war was to end today. Even if that war was to end today, I just do not see that. 952-946-6205, 952-946-6205. I just got this sent to me. So have you signed up for Threads yet? Have you got a Threads account yet?
I have not signed up for Threads.
Patrick, gotta get up there, man. I need your sports takes. Patrick, I'm there. 100 million other people have now signed up for Threads. And I can't repeat what Elon Musk said about who's the guy that runs Facebook? Zuckerberg.
Yeah, Mark Zuckerberg.
I can't repeat it. He basically, if you want to know a sign that Elon Musk is in big trouble and Twitter's in big trouble, it's the fact that Elon Musk, the head of Tesla, the head of SpaceX, the owner of Twitter, went up there and made vulgar comments about Mark Zuckerberg because Zuckerberg is starting to kick his butt. Now, you could say to yourself, well, Matt, that's only 100 million. Twitter's at 400. Yeah. But that's a quarter of the Twitter accounts right there. And here's the problem for Twitter. This is from CNBC. I'll just read this here. Threads reached 100 million signups for the weekend. That's mostly organic demand, and we haven't even turned on many promotions yet. Can't believe it's only been 5 days, and they haven't opened it up to the EU yet. That hasn't happened yet. Twitter appears to have taken a hit. Matthew Prince, CEO of Cloudflare, shared a screenshot on Twitter Sunday showing that traffic on the platform was tanking, absolutely tanking, which means that, sure, this might only be a quarter of their people, but if it's the people who are consistently making posts and they basically said, screw you to Elon Musk, and they've headed over to Threads, and I can tell you right now, because I'm up on Threads, Matthew McNeil 1 is the official station page on Threads, or the show page, I should say, on Threads. If you go up on Threads, I can tell you right now, there's a lot of people who used to post regularly on Twitter that are not posting on Twitter anymore, but are posting constantly on Threads. So he's got a big problem because I think a lot of the people that were fueling his click data are gone between Threads and Blue Sky and Mastodon. I think he is losing. The only things left are the trolls. And yeah, that's not going to make you any money. According to SimilarWeb, a data company that specializes in web analytics, web traffic on Twitter was down 5% for the first full 2 days Threads was generating compared to its previous week. The company said Twitter's web traffic is now down 11% compared to the same days in 2022, 1 year ago. Twitter responded to CNBC's request for comment with an automated response. Meta didn't offer any additional comment. And once again, here is Elon Musk. This is a guy that's apparently the face of Tesla. He's the face of SpaceX, putting out vulgar tweets towards Mark Zuckerberg because little angry guy is getting his caboose kicked. And he's about to lose $44 billion because I don't see how Twitter survives this. If this trend continues, especially when the EU opens up, because I got to imagine one of the main reasons why Twitter hasn't really tanked completely is because the EU hasn't been able to get up on Threads yet. But when the EU gets up on Threads, good luck, man. Twitter is done. 952-946-6205, 952-946-6205. We'll take a break. Come on back. A few other stories to get to before we get to the end of the show. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It's the Matt McNeil Show. I was at that game yesterday. Patrick, I was at that game yesterday. Did you go? You were saying you were thinking about going. Did you go to the game yesterday?
I wasn't up for it, so I just kind of, but I can tell you, after you finish your story, I have a little story for you that might make you, your Sunday wasn't so worth it either.
I did have the Jamaican Chirk Chicken Bowl. Have you had that yet?
Which stand is that from?
It's on the first floor on the main concourse. And it's right there next to the Herbeck stand, right behind it by the big Spalding glove where they have the gold glove winners.
Is that the Soul Bowl?
Yeah, that's it. There you go.
Yeah, I have had the barbecue pork. That was really good.
I had the Jamaican chicken, man. That was a solid endeavor. Holy God, was that tasty. A little spicy too, which was nice. Just a little spicy though. Come on, guys. It's not off the charts. It's hard watching a team quit like that team did, and that team just freaking quit outside of I would say Solano, Julian, and and who's the catcher, Vasquez. Outside of those three guys, that entire rest of that team just freaking quit. And it's one thing to watch that in September, on September 20th, when you're 20 games out of first place and you basically have nothing to play for but tee times. It's another thing to watch a team do that that's a half game out of first place at home, getting swept by a not superstar team, a better than average team, but a team you should at least win one of those games from. And just that was a bunch of freaking quitters out there. And that was hard. For the amount of money I spent on tickets, that was hard to go watch a bunch of freaking quitters. What was your thoughts on that? What's your story?
I was going to say that's definitely everybody was feeling good. Oh, but you beat up on the really, the Royals aren't exactly the 1927 Yankees.
Exactly.
So yesterday, while you were there, I went over and I stood in line for 90 minutes at that certain new chicken stand over at Ridgedale.
Okay.
And I got my food and it was cold. And I go, how were there 90 minutes of people in front of me and I got cold food?
That's actually a good question. Let's not say the name of the place. I don't want anyone getting upset with you. But that's actually a good point. You'd think to yourself, that stuff should be blazing hot, like right out of the fryer. You know what I mean? It should be like, you need to give this a few minutes to cool down because we're making it so fast and furious.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. But yeah, you, like I said, we won't name it, but you've probably heard of it if you followed the news.
Man, that's just wrong, dude. You owe Patrick some warm chicken. You owe Patrick some warm chicken. Damn it. 952-946-6205. All right. A motorist remains in the hospital Monday and under arrest on suspicion of being under the influence of drugs when he caused a Robbinsdale crash that killed a minivan driver and severely injured her husband. The driver, who died Saturday night at North Memorial Health Hospital, is identified by the Hennepin County Medical Office as Emily Girding, 34, of Crystal. Her vehicle was hit broadside by the suspect's car on the intersection of North Orchard and 36th Avenues. Following a brief pursuit by police, the Robbinsdale officer called off the chase. The driver continued to speed up to 90 miles an hour before the fatal crash. Give you an idea, once again, I got hit flush square in the back in December at 35 to 40 miles an hour, and that broke my back. And if not for the structural integrity of a Toyota Sienna, I probably would not be here, because that was 35, 40. This guy was at 90. Unbelievable. Girding's husband, 34-year-old John Girding, was taken by ambulance to North Memorial and was critical but stable condition on Monday morning, said Captain John Elder. The Girdings worked as special education teachers in Coon Rapids Middle School. According to a spokeswoman from the Anoka-Hennepin County School District, John Girding joined the staff in August 2019. Emily came on board October 2020. Spokesperson said the surviving driver, identified in a search warrant as 20-year-old Quentin Leon Hudson of Minneapolis, was transported from the crash scene to North Memorial for treatment and non-critical injuries. Elder said Hudson is being held on suspicion of criminal or vehicular operation, the captain said. The warrant, which police filed Sunday seeking permission to test Hudson's blood for drug use, notes the officers have concluded that at the time Hudson was driving under the influence of a controlled substance. Blood samples were collected by police. The filing noted the test results are pending. The Girdings, daughters, 66-year-old Amelia, 2-year-old Eleanor, thankfully were not in the vehicle at the time, but now have to prepare for a funeral for their mom. You have to put out some harsher penalties. I get it. A lot of liberals out there say, Matt, the drugs, Matt. Yeah, but was he forced to take the drugs? No. He was taking the drugs on his own accord. And he was fleeing police. The way you stop this, in my mind, is to make a deterrent. You kind of have to make a cautionary tale. Because you got some of these 18, 19, 20-year-old kids who are flying down the roads with reckless abandon. And the feeling that they seem to have is that, well, sure, I'll be on home arrest with Netflix and DoorDash. What's the big deal? And then they kill somebody with their car. And if you don't have a punishment that's substantial, you haven't done a damn thing to deter this. So I killed someone with a car. They're saying I'm going to go to jail for 2 years, and I got to enter in a program, and then I'm on house arrest for 2 years, and I get DoorDash and Netflix, and you know, okay, I can deal with that. This woman didn't deserve to die in any capacity whatsoever. These kids did not deserve to lose their parent. You have to make an example of this situation. You have to make an example that when someone is driving a car and they have stolen the car and all of a sudden they see the police lights behind them, they say to themselves, hey, do I want to go to jail for 5 years or 25 years or 30 years or 40 years? I'm tired. I am once again a person who has been very clear to say that you have to fix the criminal justice system in this country because it has been unbelievably biased towards minorities. It is undeniable. And I am all for that. But there's a dead person here. A dead person who is probably just out, maybe going on a date night with her husband. maybe just driving around through the city, who did nothing wrong. And when you sit there and you say, oh, we're going to give them probation, all you're doing is re-victimizing the family. I'm not saying it's going to stop people from doing it completely, but if you can stop one or two people from getting killed by a psychopathic teenager in a freaking stolen car plowing at 90 miles an hour through the city streets, well, that might be a good point. And the reality is, this person clearly has not been leading a good life. And it might be better for us as a society to say the choices this individual has made have forfeited their right to be part of society for a substantial part of time. This isn't some trumped up three strikes crap. This person was on drugs, driving a car. Trust me, an alleged drunk driver broke my back. I have no pity. None. Not in the day of Uber and all these other things. Nope. I have no pity. None. Don't look at me and say, you need to understand. No, I don't understand. I don't need to understand. The person was on drugs, driving a vehicle, driving at 90 miles an hour, running away from the police, and killed somebody. And there's nothing, there's no other person that you can point to that is responsible other than Quentin Leon Hudson. And he needs to go to jail for a substantial amount of time for murder, because that's what he did. Might not have been a gun, might not have been a knife, it was a car, and he murdered somebody. I hope that there is some sort of fundraising page for the family. I would encourage people to go out there and donate if they can and help out this family, because obviously it's going to be, I'm not sure about the severity of the injuries to the dad. You don't know. I mean, is this a situation where their entire life is completely changed and upended? And, you know, you have to have some consequences here. 2 years of Netflix and DoorDash while they wear an ankle bracelet, that's not going to cut it. So I get it. Don't get me wrong. Lesser crimes that are being, you know, when they basically, they accuse George Floyd of having a counterfeit $20 bill, which they don't seem to have ever found, and said there was some minor drug use. Okay. That didn't warrant him being murdered in the street by four police officers, although there are a lot of police officers in the city of Minneapolis and their supporters who think that that was a righteous kill. Undeniably, you got to fix some things. This is not one of those cases. This is an individual who killed somebody with a car. You have to have some level of consequences. 952-946-6205. Speaking of driving, one thing I do want to give everyone a heads up on. Florida's new out-of-state driver's license law is probably going to impact Minnesota drivers. On July 1st, out-of-state licenses from Delaware, Connecticut, Hawaii, Rhode Island, and Vermont are no longer valid in Florida if the driver is in the U.S. illegally. By October, Minnesota could join the list. What the Florida law says is that there has to be proof of lawful residence in the United States, explains David Schultz, a political science professor at Hamline University. If they stop someone from out of state, they're not lawful in the U.S., they will issue perhaps a citation for driving without a license. Former Governor Ron DeSantis says the new law is designed to crack down on undocumented immigrants. Right now, Minnesota only issues licenses to drivers who can prove their residency in the United States. But as of October 1st, a state law will allow licenses to be issued to anyone who qualifies, including those who lack proper, proper documentation, that basically don't have documentation that says they're a lawful resident. They will still be able to get a driver's license. And once again, this is because a lot of businesses, they need to have people that can get to the business. And frankly, they hire a lot of undocumented workers in the state. And that's the great ugly truth of the United States. We need the undocumented workers to work. And so we need to make sure they're getting to work. And so that's kind of one of the things we're looking at. In Florida, they're looking at ways to try to hurt these people. And as a matter of fact, they're so concerned in Florida right now, the Republicans are, the far-right Republicans, have you not seen any of these? These are pretty hilarious speeches. The same far-right Republicans who passed this law have now gone back to their districts. And the farmers in these districts have chewed their butts because they're losing all their long-time, you know, undocumented worker help that they've had on these fields. And so these far right people are now going out there and saying, tell your workers I'll never enforce this law. That's what he's saying. That's what he's saying. That is what the Republicans are down to. It's like, you know, we passed this law and sure, people are leaving in droves, but we'll never enforce it. Wow. What a state, Florida. So basically, Minnesota licenses, it could be, you know, are could be illegal in Florida starting October 1st. Considering the amount of snowbirds that go down there, that actually could be a bit of a problem. And so good luck with that. I don't go to Florida. There's no way in hell I'm going to Florida. Are you crazy? That state is a freaking mess. 952-946-6205, 952-946-6205. Take a break, come back. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota, the Matt McNeil Show. So how much of sore losers are Republicans? Well, we have an appeals court ruling, folks. Dust off your face masks. Here you go. Governor Tim Walz acted within his authority by mandating face masks after declaring a public health emergency during the COVID-19 pandemic. A state court of appeals ruled on Monday. The appellate court sought to answer the single question, does the Minnesota Emergency Management Act of 1996 authorize the declaration of peacetime emergency based on public health emergency, such as the COVID-19 pandemic? In an opinion written by Judge Michelle Larkin for the three-judge panel, so it was unanimous, that also included Judge Kevin Ross and Senior Judge Roger Klapke, C-L-A-P-H-A-K-E, Klapke. Sounds like Will Ferrell doing Harry Carey. Klapke. The court found that Walz acted appropriately. The Upper Midwest Law Center challenged the mask requirement, cutting-edge lawsuit requirement, as an unconstitutional infringement on residents' rights. On behalf of a group of plaintiffs, the center claimed Walz's declaration of peacetime emergency during the pandemic exceeded his powers. God, you guys are funny. Hey, guys, by the way, nope. No, that wasn't, it didn't exceed his powers. No, that's the appeals court has said no. The case started in Ramsey County, where Judge John Guthman sided with Walz and dismissed the case. The plaintiffs appealed to the state Supreme Court. The matter landed back in the Court of Appeals. Walz declared a peacetime emergency March of 2020, then implemented the face mask requirement for most of the indoor public spaces in July of 2020. Walz lifted the mask mandate in May of 2021, so the requirement is now moot, but the court still sought to answer the question. The court noted that the 1996 Minnesota Emergency Management Act grants the governor certain emergency and disaster powers to address natural and other disasters of major size and destructiveness. The plaintiff's challenge, this is something I've read a few times. It's just precious what these guys are trying to do. The plaintiff's challenge that the law primarily on the grounds of the COVID-19 was not a, quote, act of nature, because they feel the pandemic most likely originated from a lab leak, and therefore the pandemic did not occur naturally, according to the opinion. Now, most likely in this story is in air quotes, which means they can't prove this. So what they're basically saying is, we have a conspiracy theory that we think is true. We can't necessarily prove it, but it's true. But even if you were right, are you saying that Governor Walz shouldn't try to save the people of Minnesota? That basically is like, well, that's a man-made virus. We should all get wiped out. Let's all say goodbye to loved ones. A man-made virus. It's, you know, game over. We lose. Is that really your mentality? Because I would say man-made, natural. I would want the governor to try to save as many human beings as possible. That's just me, though. You know, a Christian. just, you know, Christianity, that's me. Believe in helping us, taking care of the sick, you know, trying to save lives. And, of course, that good old-fashioned welcoming in strangers from strange lands, you know. The court found that interpretation unreasonable, requiring the court to identify whether any human action had contributed at all to naturally occurring forces or events should prove impossible to resolve, the opinion said. So good for you, court, saying, you want us to declare what? It's almost embarrassing to a point that you try to present this as a legal argument. Because even you acknowledge you can't 100% say that's what happened. It might have happened, but then when does nature kick in? Because say I'm just going to go with the Republican fantasy of it. And say that the lab did leak the case and the case went out there. But the virus then does what viruses do naturally and start jumping body to body and stuff like this. So where does nature, because there's a natural element to this, which you just don't want to see. No, it was a robot creature. You can't stop the robot apocalypse. That's just law. Our new masters, our new Uber lords, the robots. I don't know where does that line even begin? I don't even know. The court also noted that all other grounds allowing the governor to declare the peacetime emergency result from human activities, including a technological failure or malfunction, a terrorist incident, an industrial accident, a hazardous material accident, and civil disobedience. So basically they said, good luck. But we'll probably see it at the Supreme Court. Native Roots Radio coming up. Greg Bach and Ghost Box Radio at 10 o'clock tonight. Make sure you're listening. We're back tomorrow. Until then, see ya.